Hi, I'm Philip Anthony Albatelli, and this is The Week in Doubt, a podcast for atheists, agnostics, and whoever, and this is episode 20. First off, if my voice sounds a little funny, I'll ask that you bear with me. I have a history of allergies, and I've been getting immunotherapy shots for years and years, but I kind of backslid with my doses a bit, and this is probably the worst allergy season I've experienced in a while. So I might sound like I have a bad cold or something, but I'll try to soldier on. I doubt this episode will be as long as some of the other ones. There's one story in general that I was waiting to cover, and it's a relatively short story, but a poignant one. And I first found out about this story through the Young Turks. I'm not sure how they find their stories so quickly, but I found it through them first, and then it started to pop up on different sites and news outlets like Wildfire. It's a story about a kitten that was buried alive, supposedly as an act of retaliation by a Mormon sect to try to send a message to a guy who had left the church. And right now, I'm just trying to double check my facts and sources. And right now, I'm getting the info I'm reading from the Huffington Post. And here's a few short paragraphs on what they have to say about it. A live cat was found recently half buried in concrete, and the man who rescued the kitten believes it was a message from a pro-polygamy religious group. The incident happened recently in Colorado City, Arizona, a major center for the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a Mormon sect that split off in the early 20th century in order to continue the controversial practice of plural marriage. The kitten was discovered at the home of Isaac Weiler, a former church member who has spoken out against the church and its controversial former leader, Warren Jeffs, according to the azfamily.com. Jeffs, who was found guilty last year of sexually assaulting two underage girls he had wed, is currently in protective custody in a prison in Palestine, Texas, serving a life term plus 20 years. So right there, you probably heard me mention a couple times Warren Jeffs, just reading that article. And I've also mentioned Warren Jeffs a few times on the show in past episodes. And the trial of Warren Jeffs was a pretty big news story not that long ago. And as I've said before, you know, I've been critical of both Scientology and Mormonism on this show, but I said, of course, not all Mormons are bad people. In fact, conversely, the majority of them are probably good people, and not every Mormon is a polygamist or a fundamentalist. But I think it's safe to say that these polygamist sects, these fundamentalist Mormon sects that believe in marrying off underage girls to old men or to adults, they're bad news. And this wouldn't be the first time I've heard about Warren Jeffs' sect in particular trying to threaten or intimidate former members. And if you're an animal lover like I am, or if you have an ounce of decency or humanity in you, this story will probably bother you. It's one of those stories where I subscribe to the Young Turks, so when I go onto YouTube, I see their most recent videos, and I saw this kind of odd picture of it's like a kitten trapped in concrete. And it the headline, it's not verbatim, but was something about kitten buried alive in concrete or something. And right away, you know, you hear that voice in your head that's like, maybe you shouldn't watch it. you know, this is probably going to disturb you. But of course, I watched it anyway. And places and news outlets, people like the Young Turks have put kind of abbreviated versions of the video up on, you know, their sites or on YouTube or whatever. But you can also find the whole video on YouTube. And the man who rescued the kitten basically documents everything from when he first found the kitten. Well, I should probably stop to explain. If you see any stills on the internet of the kitten trapped in concrete, you might see a short section of tubular concrete lying on the ground horizontally with the kitten's head sticking out of the end. But started out that this guy owns a horse ranch or something like that, and he has a series of posts and fencing up to keep his horses in. And the posts look really tall. I'm just guessing off of the top of my head. They look like maybe 12-foot posts or something like that. I'm not sure. And they're these hollow metal posts. And because I've said in the show before, I'm a graphic designer, but I also work in the family's construction, remodeling business. So I've dug a share of post holes in my day. And usually when you dig a post hole, probably depends on the code where it is. Usually it has to be like at least 4 feet deep. And so you dig out like a 4 foot hole, put the tube or the post in, and then fill it with concrete. And that's usually for, say, like a footing that's going to be used for a porch or something like that. And usually when I do it, we would take hollow sauna tubes, which are like this cardboard material, and you pour a concrete footing, plus you'd pour concrete down the tube. But in this case, these were kind of long, skinny, hollow metal poles that they were using for horse fencing. And so someone must have got a ladder or something and basically poured more concrete down into the hole, so it would have dried, you know, on top of the old concrete footing that was supporting the metal post or whatever. Then I guess, well, the cement was still wet. This is the only way I can see they did it. They must have dropped the kitten down this this long shaft down in, to land in the wet concrete at the bottom they had just poured. So the guy documents it, and well, the pole is still up, and you can hear, you know, these heartbreaking cries and meows coming from inside the pole. And so he had to cut the pole down, then he had to dig out the huge concrete footing that was holding the pole in place. And then somehow he finally got the metal casing off of the concrete. So you're left with this cylindrical, maybe, I don't know if it was 2 feet or whatever, section of concrete with a kitten's head. And I would go say an arm because of the position, you know, but foreleg, a little foreleg sticking out and the kitten's head. And it's alive, encased in concrete, and it's meowing and crying out, and it sometimes it almost sounds like tired, like it wants to give up, like its cries are really weak, but it's still crying, and it's just horrible. And whenever you see one of these stories, you always hope that you're gonna be told the animal makes it out okay. And even on the Young Turks, Anna Kasparian, the co-host, was saying that said that the kitten was saved. Then she pauses and says, temporarily. So I guess the kitten lived about 2 days, then died. So it was very harrowing to watch. I imagine it must have been very harrowing for the kitten, too. Because once they had all the metal, the metal pipe that was encasing the concrete off, they had to release the cat from the concrete. So they had to very gently just chip away with the claw end of a hammer, basically, until they removed enough of the concrete that they could remove the kitten. And when the guy finally removes the kitten and hands it to a woman, you can see even its face is, has little bits of dried concrete all over it. So it, like I said, I mean, they must have used a ladder or something, got to the top of the post, poured the wet concrete, and just dropped the kitten down, which would probably explain why it had bits of concrete on its face, too. It must have been trying to swim up to the top of the concrete, you know, just to stay alive and maintain its access to oxygen or whatever. So the kitten passed away, and I was just wondering, you know, what the heck did that kitten go through down in there? I mean, what killed it exactly? Was it the stress? How long was it there? Was it the lack of food and water? If your torso is buried in concrete, is it like you're being squeezed to death? You know, does all that dry concrete kind of constrict your lungs and your ability to breathe? So I don't know if the concrete itself took a toll on the kitten's lungs and ribs or whatever, or bones, or if just the harrowing experience took too much out of the kitten, the stress and the emotion and everything. Maybe it was a combination of things. I don't know. You know, it's one of those stories that sticks with you. I know I was walking around at work the next day and driving in my car and just trying to, you know, listen to music or focus on what I'm doing. And the idea of that cat trapped in the concrete just kept coming back to me. And if you're an animal lover or if you're easily upset, I wouldn't recommend watching it, especially because, you know, the kitten doesn't live at the end. If you knew there was a happy ending to the story, then you could probably suffer through the uncomfortable parts of it, knowing that the cat was all right in the end. But to know that the cat suffered greatly, and then after all that, being, you know, someone kind enough to rescue him and everything, and the kitten still died. Awful. And the kitten was so small, too. It was probably about the size of my Chihuahua puppy when I brought my Chihuahua home the first day. I think my Chihuahua was probably like 2.3 pounds, something like that. Which brings me to, I usually do corrections on the show. And after telling the story, I'm really not in the mood for joking, but the only correction I was going to make, and it was probably a technical one, was that if you listen to the beginning of last week's episode, you can hear a door creak open. And as soon as I started the show, basically my dog pushed open the door and started causing havoc around the room. So if you hear a loud, kind of creepy squeaking noise at the beginning of the last week's episode, that was my dog. But anyway, so I guess when I'm doing a story like this, I got to try to keep my emotions in check. Knowing that I'm a non-believer and that I'm critical of many aspects of religion, some religions more than others, like Scientology and Mormonism, you might think that I'm automatically going to jump to a conclusion and say evil Mormons or religion was responsible for this kitten's cruel treatment and death. But no, I'll say this. I think I've said this a bunch of times on the show that unlike some of my intellectual heroes like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, I'm more interested in just empirically trying to find out whether or not the claims of religions are true, rather than trying to necessarily demonize religion or say that, you know, religion is the cause for many of the world's social ills or something like that. I mean, in cases like with Mormonism and Scientology, I've kind of bashed them on this show because they're relatively new religions, and I think that their claims are so outlandish, I don't know how people in this day and age can embrace them. And then obviously there are cultic aspects to Scientology and to fundamentalist Mormon sects that practice this type of retaliation and practice underage polygamy and stuff like that. And I think someone needs to say something about that. And also, I know like Sam Harris, who I admire greatly, and Christopher Hitchens were both very, well, Sam still, unfortunately, Christopher has passed, were both very outspoken against fundamentalist religion and its role in terrorism, which is as it should be, I think. But I don't focus on things like that as much because, like I said, it's kind of my selfish goals to try to figure out whether any given religion's claims are actually empirically true or not. If I only have one life on this planet, I want to know how I got here, what it's all about. Is there not a creator? I think those are important questions. Not everyone sits around and ponders those big, possibly maddening questions like I do. We probably all do to some varying degree, but it's who I am. You know, I'm not ashamed of it. It's actually one of the things that gives me joy in life is to stay intellectually stimulated and to ponder those things. But back to the kitten and Mormonism, I think there's lots of different types of people who can commit animal cruelty, both religious and even irreligious. Often you hear a lot of stories about young kids, kind of hoodlums, people, you know, young kids, hoodlums, that's an old school word, kids who've kind of gotten off track and developed a cruel streak and they'll lash out at society or, you know, they'll commit acts of animal cruelty and things like that. And oftentimes those kids are probably existentially drifting and they're not really attached to any religion or don't believe or anything. And who knows, maybe if they did adhere to some sort of religion, a healthy religion of sorts, relatively speaking, that might have kept them from committing acts of animal cruelty. But I guess at least if it was a kid, a stupid young kid whose frontal lobe hasn't finished developing yet, you could maybe hope that they might turn into a better person when they get older. But I imagine this act of retaliation by some of Jeff's people were, these were probably adults, I would imagine. And that just brought up another thing where supposedly, according to the guy who saved the kitten, when he brought it up to the police, it was either the sheriff himself or a representative of the sheriff, said that if it was him, he just would have dumped dirt onto the kitten instead of saving it. And that's one of those things that makes you so mad, but you just feel impotent because there's nothing you can do about it. The kitten's already passed, you know, and but you just hear that and it sickens you. So I don't think that religion is necessarily responsible for this act of animal cruelty or that Mormonism is, because I think, like I said, a young punk kid could commit an act of animal cruelty, maybe even an atheist, because I think there's different types of atheists, you know. I think sometimes people think of atheists as probably being elitist, they're professors, they're this and that. And I think often, well, it's true, I think sometimes, or often, atheists tend to be people who are actually quite moral, and their sense of moral outrage of certain regarding certain aspects of the human condition and the state of the world or whatever might be part of why they don't believe. It's funny because I think sometimes religious people fear that atheism can lead to a lack of morality. Because there'd be no religious moral dogma to keep you in line or whatever. But I actually think that often atheists are driven by morality. And I think to some degree that's true with me. I think for the most part why I'm a non-believer has to do with just the conclusions I draw by looking at the world, looking at religion, looking at history, human nature, what we know about evolution and science, things like that, and just coming to a natural conclusion that in light of all we know, religions seem man-made. There could be a God out there, but if there is, I think all our religious texts are just examples of man groping in the dark, and they're not the God-given word from a creator, if there is one. But I think there can be another type of atheist, too. There could be like a nihilistic atheist, someone who's maybe not terribly intelligent, or someone who has a mean streak. Could even be like a psychopath who's antisocial, doesn't believe in God or anything like that, and they just want to lash out at society. So someone like that, and that probably in a way kind of keeping with the mindset of the kind of young punk kid I was theoretically talking about, but technically an adult criminal could probably be like that too. We have someone who doesn't believe in God and just wants to lash out, and they could hurt an animal too. And in fairness, I think often religion can go either way in the case of animal, how you treat animals. A religious person might say, well, animals are God's creation. So even though they might concede that according to religious thinking, animals are meant to be human resources to some degree and wear the crown of creation, a good-hearted person might also argue that they're God's creations, they're fellow beings, and we're meant to be their caretakers. So you could easily have a religious person who loves animals. In this case, where you have a fundamentalist form of Mormonism, where the most important thing to them is kind of ignorantly and cruelly lashing out at what they view as apostates or betrayers of the faith, they care more about sending a message and bullying former members than they do about being good people, it appears. And that's kind of the hypocritical thing, I think. These people are supposedly driven by faith and religion. God is everything to them, if God made everything, if God made animals, didn't God make that little kitten, that sentient little being that was crying out for help after you entombed it alive in concrete? Wasn't that little kitten God's creation? Didn't that little kitten deserve the mercy and respect that a innocent creation of God should deserve? So I think it's hypocritical, it's barbaric, it's primitive. They obviously put their own selfish desires for retaliation above God and the well-being of their fellow creatures, human and animal. Well, technically we're animals, I have a Darwinian worldview. But I don't know, it's just crazy. It's one of those stories that makes you want to pull your hair out, but it's over and done. The kitten's already gone. There's nothing you can do to turn back time and save it. But I don't know, maybe if people raise a big enough stink and send the message to these people that you're not going to get anywhere by hurting an innocent animal. And you're not going to get people to like you anymore. You're not going to win converts to your faith, except for maybe the sickest type, by hurting innocent creatures. And here, that's one of the good things about living in this the age of YouTube and the internet, is that whether it's cases of despotism, despotism overseas, as the case of all the atrocities going on in Syria and things like that, or whether it's a case like this, some fundamentalist religious nuts torturing an innocent animal, that we can now shine a light on these people and we can expose them more readily. And who knows? I don't know if these people are capable of being shamed, but maybe if the enlightened world, the world at large, lets them know that we're not going to accept that type of behavior, that it's just going to make you look more degenerate and primitive in our eyes when you commit atrocious acts like that, maybe their behavior will change. That's probably wishful thinking, but here's the hoping that someone can save the next poor animal before they can get their hands on it. I don't know. And I'm not condoning violence or saying, you know, someone should go do something crazy to these people. I'm condoning shaming them, shining a light on them, and trying to prevent animal cruelty whenever we can. This is just crazy stuff. And I remember when I decided I wanted to cover this story, I also decided this doesn't necessarily have to do with religion. And here I go zigzagging all over the place, and I apologize. But I was just talking about whether religion is responsible for the way, you know, people treat animals, or specifically in this case. And I was saying that fairness to religion, you know, all sorts of different people who believe in all sorts of different things could possibly commit an act of animal cruelty. It's doesn't have to be solely ascribed to you know, sick religious beliefs. In this particular case, I think religion probably did have a good amount to do with that kitten's ultimate demise, though. I'm not saying Mormon scripture in general, but this warped take on Mormonism, this kind of degenerate cultic strain of Mormonism, where people viewed Warren Jeffs as almost this divine figure, this prophet-like figure, and even in jail, he still has control over these people. And these people probably care about more about their own tribal pride and their allegiance to Warren Jeffs than they do the life of an innocent creature. And they're obviously indoctrinated into Warren Jeffs' sick worldview. So in a sense, I think the cultic beliefs of this particular Mormon fundamentalist group, which you could consider their religious beliefs, did play a huge role in the demise of this poor animal. If they hadn't been followers of Warren Jeffs, they probably wouldn't have felt the compulsion to do this. I mean, I can't say that certainly. Maybe some of these people were sick before they started following Warren Jeffs. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to talk to before I the other thing I wanted to talk about before I had digressed back onto that other topic was a question I sometimes ask myself, that, and maybe some of you are like this too, why am I more easily disturbed by news stories that have to do with cruelty to animals than I am sometimes about stories that have to do about cruelty to my fellow humans, members of my own species? And maybe you're like that too. I think we get kind of inured or somewhat hardened to stories about human violence and cruelty because we hear stories like that day in, day out. It seems every day you turn on the local news or the national news, you're hearing stories about shootings and robberies and people beating other people, road rage, wars overseas, war crimes, whatever it is. So it seems like day in, day out, we're constantly hearing stories about man's inhumanity to man, and maybe we do get a little hardened to that, or we become a little apathetic over time. And I think it might also be that as members of the species, maybe we also develop a kind of complicated relationship with our fellow humans. You know, I'm sure all of us have people we like more than others, or even people we do like. There's things we like about them, things we don't. And so we can have a complicated view of our fellow humans. even though at the end of the day, it should be hopefully a humane view. And hopefully we wish well for our fellow man and try to do right by them whenever we can. But as humans, we have a light side and a dark side, good impulses, bad impulses. We have complex views of our fellow humans. And I think maybe conversely, when it comes to animals, you know, we don't have that same type of complex relationship with them. One of the charms of animals is that it's usually a simpler, cleaner relationship. You know, if you see an animal in the wild that you're admiring, you know, it's a bird on the branch or a squirrel or whatever, or your own cat or dog, you usually perceive them with a kind of innocence. You know, animals, especially puppies and kittens, they're like almost like living stuffed animals. They're like these little innocent creatures. You might have a complicated view of animals if, like me, you were terrorized by dogs as a young kid and had a fear of dogs. I remember as a young kid, the leash law wasn't nearly as strictly enforced as it is now. So you had to kind of roam the back streets of your own hometown with a kind of, you know, at your own risk in a sense, because you never knew when a dog was going to come charging out of a yard and try to take a bite out of your leg. And I imagine, you know, being a paperboy back then was a particularly perilous profession. I think one of my older brothers had a paper route and was bitten by a German Shepherd back in the day. So I remember I had this horrible fear of dogs as a little kid, but also we had dogs growing up, and I always loved them. And as I grew older, I gained even a greater appreciation for animals in general and became even more of a dog person. And I don't have any fear of dogs anymore. But barring some kind of weird fear of a particular animal, I imagine, especially with domestic animals, we have a kind of, you know, we view them as kind of the embodiment of innocence, kind of like small kids. And add on top of that the fact that they look like animated teddy bears. They look like, you know, living stuffed animals. It's easy to understand why we're so empathetic and sympathetic towards them. So when you hear a story, and there have been many of them, of people tossing little dogs out of moving car windows, or I remember seeing one story about a chihuahua that had been stolen from its owner, tortured in this abandoned building by these two kids, burned alive, somehow managed to survive. And I just remember the heartbreaking image of the female owner getting the dog back and being so grateful to have the dog back again. But the dog was all scarred and burned. Most of its ears were gone. I remember a story. I think the dog's name was Leo. It was a Bichon Frise, and this was a few years back at least. I forget where it took place, but this woman had been on the highway, caught in bumper-to-bumper traffic, and she accidentally bumped the bumper of the car ahead of her. And this nutbag guy, who, I don't know if he had anger management issues or whatever, you know, got out of the car, came up to her, and I guess she had her window partially down. She wanted to apologize or something. The guy reached in, took her little white fluffy Bichon Frise Leo, and hurled it into one of the other lanes where the traffic was going at normal speed on the highway. The dog landed into the highway traffic and was killed. And I don't even want to know what that dog went through or what toll the traffic took on its poor little body. But that's one of those stories to me that still sickens me, and I wish I could punch the guy in the face. Like I said before, you know, I'm not advocating violence, but that's how I feel. And I remember when that story first came out and the guy got brought to court and he tried to sheepishly play innocent or coy and say, oh, I would never do anything like that. And he was kind of a scrawny, balding guy. Not that there's anything wrong with being scrawny and balding, but, you know, I just have so much antipathy towards that guy. And I just picturing this, I was almost going to swear. Well, I will. What the hell? This shitty, scrawny, rotten little guy who took that poor little animal's life. And not just the suffering of the animal, but the suffering that he caused in the owner as well, and heartbreak, you know. Damn. And I remember wishing, I think, you know, maybe it's extreme. I think if you take a pet, someone's pet, a domestic animal, you know, a cat or a dog, and throw it into highway traffic like that, me personally, I'd give you at least 20 years. I don't know if that might sound extreme to some, but I guess all of us put a, you know, it's a sliding scale. All of us put a different amount of value on the life of an animal. And I know you could argue philosophically that's somewhat hypocritical because most of us eat meat. And why is it all right to slaughter some animals and not others? Well, I think I've addressed that kind of built-in hypocrisy if you're a meat eater, but also have a love of animals. And that's me. I am hypocritical in a way. But if you've been following the show, you also know that I stopped eating pork after seeing the footage of abuse by a Tyson provider or whatever that was in the news not that long ago, where they're kicking and beating the pigs to the point where one of the pigs died right there on the concrete floor on its side, with one of the investigative reporter, undercover reporter, in vain trying to pour water and food into the pig's mouth. The way they chucked the piglets around like they were inanimate objects. We know that pigs, as much as we love dogs, pigs are probably even smarter than dogs, and in certain ways they're uncannily similar to us genetically, you know, to the point where we can use pig valves as replacements for the human heart, things like that. Well, I think that there are some differences, understandable differences between our, you know, between the way we view some animals and other ones. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way certain animals have evolved along with us, or the way they've been bred by us. In the case where if you look at livestock, like cows, for instance, obviously, if you know anything about world religion, you know that in Hinduism, the cow is considered a sacred animal. So it is possible to find areas of the world where it's forbidden to, say, kill a cow, an animal that we readily kill in our society. And there are places in the world where, as disturbing as it is to us, dogs are killed and eaten. And I guess that's when supposedly cultural relativity, that term you find used among sociologists and anthropologists, which means trying to keep an objective or open eye on how you view different societies in relation to your own and their cultural mores or practices. But I'd say for the most part, man has a long history with the dog in this almost kind of symbiotic relationship, and for most of man's history, the dog hasn't been food. It's been a kind of ally, an employee, a companion. And as we know, the dog is almost genetically identical to the wolf. And I think there's a couple of theories about how the wolf became domestic. We might have had some particularly bold yet good-natured wolves that happen to, unlike their skittish brethren or aloof brethren who try to keep clear of humans, they actually, something in them allowed them to be curious and to approach human settlements, live on the outskirts of those settlements even, and scavenge our garbage, basically. And so it could have been that these certain wolves became more and more good-natured and domesticated, so they could continue living around our settlements, we eventually tamed them and put them to work as guard dogs, as hunting partners, as companions that keep us warm at night, things like that. But I think there's also a theory that early human hunters may have found wolf pups in the wild, brought them back to their settlements. It's possible that the dogs that were quite feral in temperament may have been killed, but the dogs, the puppies that were relatively good-natured and primed to be tamed or domesticated, that temperament was promoted as these good-natured wolf pups were bred with one another, and eventually you ended up with a domestic dog. And I remember, I don't know the name of the scientist, but the relatively recent history, because they have video footage of it, there was a Russian scientist who actually took wild foxes and started breeding the ones with the best temperament with one another. And I think it only took a few generations before you started to get more and more domesticated animals. And also, it's interesting, they also started to show physical traits of domestic dogs, where the fox pups start to develop. I think the fox pups, but they're probably born with upright ears. But the fox pups, or the grown domestic foxes, were displaying domestic dog traits like floppy ears, mottled or spotted coats. So it seems like that gave scientists some kind of insight that some of the differences between wolves and domesticated dogs physically, like some dogs have floppy ears, some dogs have kind of spotted coats. Those might have been just accidental side effects of the domestication process, that there might be some kind of genes that are linked to, that domesticated temperament are also linked to floppy ears or spotted coats or whatever. But anyway, I think where, say, cattle has long been raised as a food source, dogs for most of their history were used, although dogs have been eaten in history, whether it was in cases of food shortages or Far Eastern cultures that even to this day practice eating dogs. For the most part, dogs were companion animals, guardians, hunting partners, watchdogs, that type of thing. And even, you go back to ancient Egypt and you can find images of dogs hanging out with the pharaoh and his family on tomb walls and things like that. And there's some really old breeds, like in the Middle East, there's the Saluki, which is an ancient hunting dog that's still around. And seems to be well respected by the people who use it for hunting. So I think that, in a way, might kind of explain why some animals we look at as food and some we have more of a emotional attachment to. And even cats have been domesticated for a long time. And once again, in ancient Egypt, the cat was revered. So that might explain why we treat some animals better than others, or our heart bleeds a little more for them than others. But obviously, as modern, moral, self-aware beings, I think we should have respect for all animals and not cause any undue suffering when we can help it towards any fellow creature. But wow, I think I've probably gone on long enough. I said that this was going to be a relatively short episode, and right now, before the editing, we're up to 46 minutes and counting. So it just goes to show I can pretty much be a windbag on any subject. But there's some food to thought. Maybe you'll stop and think about your own attitude towards animals. Stop and give your own cat an extra scratch behind the ears, or your dog an extra pat on the head. But anyway, that's a disturbing story about the kitten and the concrete. And like I said, if you're an animal lover and you already know the story doesn't have a happy ending, you may want to avoid it. But anyway, this has been The Week in Doubt once again. And if you want to give me a review on iTunes, I would much appreciate it. That would be awesome. If you want to like the Facebook page, that would be great. If you want to visit Podbean, podbean.com, and look for The Week in Doubt there. You can look at all the old posts, listen to all the old episodes. Maybe you can leave a comment or a rating. And you can also subscribe and get the old episodes through iTunes as well. All right, thank you.